Hello there. Today is Tuesday, March 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Muslim community steps up to support families of the victims in New Zealand. A shooting in the Netherlands puts a city on lockdown for the entire day.
So we have now arrested him. We do not know as yet as to what his motives are.
Also ahead, where the National Football League and country music are converging. It's all on today's International Edition. Residents of Christchurch, New Zealand, have been bringing flowers and other mementos to a makeshift memorial. And an online fund for the victims gathered $684,000 in a single day. The victims of Friday's shooting included immigrants from Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Turkey, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Shootings and violent crime are rare in New Zealand, a country of nearly 5 million people. The gunman's desire for infamy was made clear by the fact that he left behind a convoluted 74-page manifesto before Friday's massacre and live-streamed footage of his attack on the Al-Noor Mosque. Here in the United States, President Trump has been coming under fire for his lack of a stronger response in denouncing Islamophobia and white supremacy. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney tells Fox News that President Trump has taken an appropriate stand against white supremacists.
You've seen the president stand up for religious liberties, individual liberties. The president is not a white supremacist. I'm not sure how many times we have to say that. And to simply ask the question every time something like this happens overseas, or even domestically, to say, oh my goodness, it must somehow be the president's fault, speaks to a politicization of everything that I think is undermining sort of the institutions that we have in the country today.
Well, joining us now to talk more about how the Muslim community is responding here in the United States is Abbas Barzagar, Director of Research and Advocacy at the Council on American Islamic Relations. So thank you for being with us. How do you think the government of New Zealand has dealt with this crisis so far?
It's exemplary moral leadership and what we expect out of our world leaders. And so the Muslim community, both from what we hear in New Zealand and Australia, as well as everybody in largely Western countries that we've heard from, as well as the coverage that's happening in the Middle East, just very relieved to be able to see somebody at the national level really embrace a community in a time of struggle like this and also bring the country together with kind of unwavering commitment in that way. And so we've seen the same out of some Australian leadership, and I think they've really set the tone and pace where a lot of other leaders have failed.
Here in the United States, President Trump has been getting a lot of criticism for how he has handled it. But his chief of staff has come out vehemently denying that the president is anti-Muslim or Islamophobic. How do you react to that?
Look, the fact of the matter is President Trump has said things about Muslims, has instituted policies about Muslims, and has repeatedly fanned the flames of anti-Muslim bigotry, Islamophobic rhetoric. One wonders what's happening there, other than to say this is what he genuinely believes.
Why do you think anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim hate, along with hate in general, is on the rise across the globe?
Hate has the same DNA wherever you find it. I spent a number of years as a university professor, and I was studying propaganda by Islamic extremist groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda and others. And what you find is that there's the same sort of DNA code to this type of propaganda. And what it really does is it harps upon perceived injustices, perceived vulnerabilities. It really indulges in a kind of victim mentality. And what it does is it creates a mythology that a people is being victimized and that this people has a historic mission on earth and it has a kind of historic pride that is being now debased by another group. And it's really just a lot of fantasy. And the reason that that's happening is the world is globalized, and the more globalized the world becomes and the more interaction there is, and frankly, the better things get by way of trade, culture, health, science. There are also times where cultures get a little bit disrupted, and there's times where people's lives change and things start changing. There's more interaction. People who never saw other people in their entire life from other backgrounds are all of a sudden new people and new realities and differences. And then in that moment of transition, in that moment of change, you have really people who exploit these vulnerabilities. There is really a predatory mindset to the people who participate in this kind of discourse.
Since this happened over the weekend, is CARE doing anything in response to this to support the Muslim community?
We have over 30 chapters across the United States. And those chapters are deeply embedded within civil society infrastructure of American Muslim life. And so our chapters across the country are each responding locally to their local needs. Like right now, I know that CARE staff and CARE executives are working with mosques around the country to provide debriefings on best practices and security for your mosques. We're providing people with resources on how to talk to your children, how to talk to your families. And for those that are still in need, we have a series of webinars taking place this week.
I would imagine trying to explain what happened to a young child would be very difficult.
Yeah, that's really what's happening, is a lot of families are quite broken up. And we're also trying to take care of our own community workers, like our educators and our teachers who are teaching children and have to deal with that. They suffer quite a bit themselves because they have to explain this. They don't have the time to process it themselves. So we spend a lot of time focusing on the mental health need, focusing on physical safety. All of our chapters have strong relationships with local law enforcement.
Do you feel encouraged by the outpouring from people around the world on this?
Absolutely. Around the world and in our local communities, you're finding rabbis standing rank and rank with Muslims in the front row praying, finding Christians showing up and holding down, guard positions around the mosque. This is a result, really, of a long culture, to be honest, since 9/11, where Muslim communities and Christian communities and Jewish communities have been coming together to basically stand united in the face of threats posed to the wider community. Some of the beautiful stories that are emerging, for example, out of the Tree of Life synagogue community in Pittsburgh, the Muslim community nationwide raised, almost $250,000 or something to support families in the local community there. And the Jewish Fund of Greater Pittsburgh, it might be called, has just raised a substantial amount of money to support the Muslim community in New Zealand at this time. And so, this is really what we believe America is about, mindful of everybody's grief at this time. But there are some really, really encouraging moments.
All right. That's Abbas Barzagar, Director of Research and Advocacy at the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Thank you so much for being with us. In the Netherlands, a gunman opened fire during a mid-morning tram ride Monday in the Dutch city of Utrecht, raising the specter of another extremist attack only days after the murderous rampage in New Zealand. Justice Minister Ferd Grapperhaus.
The suspect allegedly shot three people and very seriously wounded three others and more likely wounded two others. Allegedly, he had an automatic weapon. After the assault, he fled from the crime scene.
Authorities seized a Turkish-born suspect after a manhunt that convulsed the historic city of nearly 350,000 people for most of the day. Grapperhaus says the suspect was known to justice authorities and had a criminal record.
Fortunately, a person was on camera, on the surveillance camera of the tramway. So we were able to very soon spot him, to also connect him through a runaway car in which he had fled from the place of the assault. So we have now arrested him. We do not know as yet as to what his motives are.
Police said they also detained another man on suspicion of involvement, but released no details. The Utrecht attack took place at a busy intersection in a residential neighborhood. The gunman was alleged to have had an automatic weapon. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Cameroon protests U.S. criticism during the Naji visit. 1,000 Venezuelans forces deserted since February. The death toll in the jihadist ambush on Malian soldiers hits 23, and a Sudan amputee protester is inspiring anti-government demonstrators. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. More than 150 people have been killed and hundreds more missing after Cyclone Idai swept through southeastern Africa with the Mozambican city of Beira, the hardest hit. Teams of aid workers with the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies reached the devastated city Sunday to assess the situation. The cyclone made landfall last week with winds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour before moving west to Malawian Zimbabwe. Reporter Adi Gondo has details.
Zimbabwe's southeastern region has in the past 2 days experienced one of the country's worst humanitarian disasters in decades, with hundreds of people displaced, homes swept away, and massive property damage lying in its wake. Cyclone Idai's death toll stands at 31 people dead and counting. Scores of people are reported missing and unaccounted for. President Emmerson Mnangagwa had left the country on a state visit to Abu Dhabi on Friday, just before the cyclone. He announced from overseas that a rescue effort was in place, with the army set to move into the affected area. But the officials on the ground say this is yet to happen. Roads and bridges in most parts of Chimanimani and Chipinge, the hardest hit areas, were swept away by flooding. That leaves the region, which lies in a valley and borders Mozambique, inaccessible to the rest of the world. The Chimanimani Hotel is busy receiving distressed residents fleeing the flood. Mandla Mataore is a manager at the hotel.
It's been very chaotic. The cyclone came through and, it's devastated us. So last night there were very heavy winds and rain. And we woke up this morning and, there's been a lot of casualties. Well, the numbers are growing. We're on about 390 so far. They're from the Ngangu village mainly, but from all over. Well, we need everything. I mean, we need medical supplies. We need blankets, clothing. People's houses have been taken away. So you can imagine they've just got the clothes on their back and whatever they could salvage. We're marooned, unfortunately, because where we are, the only other access point would be through Chimoyo in Mozambique, which obviously is another place where this cyclone came from, that side anyway.
All residents of the affected area were warned about the impending disaster. The destruction was far greater than expected. For now, appeals are being made for tents, food, and medicines to assist the injured. And the country needs all the help it can get. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
And Amnesty International has released a scathing criticism in response to reports that the U.S. will restrict visas for international criminal court personnel. Daniel Balson, advocacy director at Amnesty International USA, in the statement said that the announcement was the latest attack on international justice and international institutions by an administration, quote, hell-bent on rolling back human rights protections. He said the ICC prosecutes the most serious crimes under international law, including genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity, and that impeding investigators' work disrupts its vital function and sets a dangerous precedent. I talked about it with criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, who was at the International Criminal Court in The Hague when the news came to light. So, Jack, what can you explain about what has happened here?
The United States has denied visas to ICC, International Criminal Court investigators, looking at potential war crimes by American soldiers, CIA officers, and even American allies. It's really an extraordinary effort. And what we've also seen is an effort by the United States to delegitimize the ICC.
Where were the investigations specifically?
At this point, they were looking at things that were going on in Afghanistan, but it actually goes a bit further than that, because what we also find is that Palestine, the ICC considers a state, Palestine was making claims against the Israelis, again, American allies, and they were looking at that issue as well. Essentially, what's going on is that the Palestinians went to the ICC and said, look, we have issues of war crimes. We want you to look at this issue. Mm-hmm. They did a short investigation in the first place to see if they should move forward. They said, we should at least move forward to determine if something is worthy of going further upon. And that's where they stopped, because the Americans are essentially trying to stop those investigations.
Why do you think they are trying to throw these roadblocks, and how does the United States have the authority to do this?
Well, in this case, the United States is not a member of the IC. There's 123 countries that are all parties to the Rome Statute. This was put into force with a treaty back in 2002. The Americans are not technically a part of that. But again, they have the ability to control their own borders. They have the ability to control an investigation that takes place within their own country. So technically, they have the right to make the decision on who comes in and what that means. At the same time, that doesn't mean that they can stop the ICC from doing an investigation independently about whether the United States committed war crimes in Afghanistan.
Are we talking about crimes that may have been committed during this current administration, Trump administration, or prior to that?
It's unclear, but my perception is that this is actually before the Trump administration. Essentially, the ICC has jurisdiction from everything from 2002 onward. So my expectation is we would be talking about something during either the Bush administration or the Obama administration.
Now, I know Amnesty International came out with a pretty harsh statement saying that while victims' rights should be the very top priority of the United States government, basically that throwing roadblocks in front of the ICC's investigation undermines justice, not only for abuses committed in Afghanistan, but also for the millions of victims and survivors throughout the world who've experienced these horrendous things under international law.
Ambassador Bolton called the ICC illegitimate. He attacked them directly, and the real purpose is to weaken them at any stage. If we're actually about trying to protect individuals who were victims in this case, it seems to me that what we really need to do is to determine what happened, to determine if, in fact, these horrible things happened and Americans were involved. That's critical. Now, what happens next is a separate question. It might be political, it might not be, but we should at least, know the truth.
Why do you think this administration has such a problem with the International Criminal Court?
If we look at what Bolton has said, again calling it illegitimate, you add President Trump himself during the campaign said that he thought we should be doing more waterboarding. Now, that is torture. So I guess if you listen to their words and you accept their words in their meaning, it's because they really don't want people to know more. And in fact, they actually want more of that. I don't think I'm going much further when you simply accept the words of the president himself and who says, I want to see more waterboarding. I think that speaks for itself.
All right. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice speaking to us earlier from the International Criminal Court in The Hague. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues. Chimpanzees are second only to humans as the most complex and diverse of the large primates. But a new report from a large group of scientists, including the Wildlife Conservation Society, say that humans are threatening the culture of our closest cousins. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Chimpanzees and the other great apes are our closest genetic relatives. They have complex cultural and behavioral habits that include tool use and sophisticated social interactions. But some new research suggests that our two species have trouble sharing the same space. When humans get too close to chimpanzees in the wild, the study says chimpanzees lose a lot of their culture.
And essentially what it found was cultural and behavioral diversity was reduced by 88% in those sites with the highest human impact.
Emma Stokes is with the Wildlife Conservation Society, which co-authored the study. She says there are a number of possible reasons why It may be that fewer chimpanzees live in areas near humans, or it could be that more people mean fewer available tools and opportunities to use them. Whatever the reason, the impact is clear.
Some form of human impact to somehow directly reduce the availability of those resources, such as logging or habitat degradation. So it somehow influences the resource base on which these behavioral activities are based.
Stokes says that chimpanzees are adaptable and, in fact, may adapt to human encroachment with entirely new behaviors. But she suggests the better solution may be to think more broadly about why a piece of land or forest deserves to be protected.
I think we should be perhaps redefining or enriching our definition of forests that have high integrity or high intactness. It's not just about keeping the trees or even keeping the wildlife. It's also about keeping that behavioral and cultural diversity.
WCS says that logging was responsible for the loss of over 77% of Africa's intact forests between 2000 and 2013. In addition to putting wildlife, local communities, and economies at risk, the new report highlights the threat the unregulated and often illegal extraction of timber poses to a unique culture. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international team of astronomers have authored a new study that details their discovery of 83 quasars that date back to when the universe was 10% of its age. To spot the quasars that couldn't be seen earlier, the astronomers used a new and innovative instrument mounted on the Subaru telescope in Hawaii. One of the study's co-authors, Michael Strauss from Princeton University, commented how remarkable it is that such massive, dense objects were able to form so quickly after the Big Bang. Quasars are generated when supermassive black holes devour materials so quickly that a buildup of friction and heat produces powerful beams of light. Supermassive black holes, which are found at the center of galaxies, are so big that their mass of each can equal millions or even billions of times more than our sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Some California students have created a virtual stock exchange for student companies, all of it simulated but realistic. As Michael Sullivan reports, the classroom project helps them understand financial markets as they learn about the challenges of business.
They consult with colleagues and pitch prospective clients. Their virtual company, called Invest, is a stock exchange based at San Juan Hills High School in California.
I think learning from books and notes and lectures is important, but this class gives you the opportunity to actually go out and perform.
The officers of the student company practice for a presentation. Their stock exchange exists in the classroom and online and uses virtual currency. It's based on the latest financial technology known as blockchain. It keeps a record of cryptocurrency transactions across computers linked to peer-to-peer networks.
So not only are they learning how to trade equities like they would in the real world, but they're also getting a little bit of exposure to blockchain technology, which is a type of finance management that they will face in the future.
The students are getting ready for a trade show in New York, like this one, sponsored by the nonprofit educational group Virtual Enterprises International. Students from around the United States showcase business projects.
So throughout the year, they're developing a business plan, they're implementing a business, their business model, developing websites and participating at trade shows and making sales back and forth to the different companies in the marketplace.
This student project goes a step further than other virtual businesses, allowing students to raise virtual money by selling stocks, just like on Wall Street.
And then we also have to look up things such as insurance policies, such as advertising. We have to create the monthly budgets so we're able to make sure our money is being put out there efficiently.
Students face all the problems of running a business.
We have 26 employees, which is a lot for a brand new company. And so that's obviously been a big challenge for us.
With a big job title comes responsibility, says the student company's chief executive officer.
It's hard to be the CEO and have everyone look up to you and expect great things from you, especially when you know, I am so young and I have so little experience of the business world. So it's been a little bit of a challenge to, you know, come into class and have a plan ready for everyone every day.
But the students say they're having fun while meeting the challenge and are learning how to run a business. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, San Juan Capistrano, California.
A juice shop in Egypt has come up with a stunt that spiked sales so much that the family-owned store's business is booming as never before. Arash Arabasadi reports.
The owner dared customers at his shop to down jugs of his sweet, sweet juice.
I challenged myself to finish the jug, and thank God I did it.
Mohammed Mustafa Dawood runs his family's Al-Bardisi juice shop in Tanta, Egypt.
There is a big turnout in a daily competition. God willing, I'll have a new competition next week.
He challenges his customers to drink 12 liters of sugarcane juice. Do that, and you could win 100 Egyptian pounds, or about $6. Lose, and you owe him.
Anyone can finish this jug. I finished it, people. I welcome whoever is next.
Dawood holds a master's degree in economics. He says the show is part of the draw to his family's 60-year-old business.
I want people to drink sugarcane juice. Last time the challenge was for one person to finish one jug. In the new one, there will be three people.
And if they finish it, they each win free juice for 6 months.
It's good publicity for the shop. It's good publicity for the drink. I hope it makes the drink famous.
Like its name implies, sugarcane juice comes from pressing the water out of sugarcane. It is a popular drink in countries like Egypt, where sugarcane is commercially grown. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The stars of the gridiron will meet the stars of Music City when the NFL draft comes to Nashville, Tennessee in April. The National Football League announcing Monday that Grammy-winning country star Tim McGraw will perform a free concert outdoors on April 26th, and Grammy-winning gospel singer CeCe Winans will sing the national anthem on April 25th. To open the 3 days of draft events. The league said that more than 20 Nashville-based acts perform with additional names to be announced soon. The draft will take place on an outdoor stage in downtown Nashville. At Negroni, like kids do. And I thought about you. I thought about me. I thought about God, everything love is, and everything it's not. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Najwan Kali. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. How we walk through it, the times I got it right. I saw hungry misspelled on a cardboard sign in a dirty t-shirt that said roll tide, so I gave him a few, and I thought about you. Ran into a buddy, said, how long's it been? I said, a couple of years. He said, boy, it's been 10. That's what time will do. I thought about you. I thought about good.
God, God, everything love is, and everything is now. Saw a red balloon, somebody just let fly. I watched it getting smaller up in the sky for a minute or two, and I thought about it.
This is VOA.